بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم thank you so much for that introduction and I don't know why you put it up because generally speaking whenever I hear anything said about myself I cringe and I can take liberty in saying that here because the one thing that I always find it fascinating amazing to come to Medina it gives me a lot of peace but one of the things that I find in this city is it's a city that celebrates humility. So for me, I like to live my life according to those principles as well. And it's embarrassing when one sees things up about oneself. Particularly so because, you know, when you introduced the idea of my coming here and you mentioned in your brochure that you're celebrating a success story, I wanted to say, well, I'm not dead yet. Alhamdulillah. And you should only celebrate success when people write epitaphs. So right now, this is a work in progress journey and one that I'm enjoying very, very much indeed. So what I'm going to talk to you about today is going to sort of span a very broad canvas. I'd like to sort of talk to you about some of my experiences. I'd like to talk to you about leadership, entrepreneurship, my views on the region. And whenever people start getting bored, if you just raise your hands, I'll switch to something else. It's a key topic for this region, whether we talk about it from a political perspective, whether we talk about it from an employment perspective. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to start off. Do you mind if I walk around? What I'd like to do is I'd like to start off by talking to you about my view of where the world is today and then bring it back into where I see the region today. The world went through a cataclysmic heart attack. It was a shock to the system in 2008. And it was a shock that a lot of people in a feeling of some euphoria today feel that it's over and done with and that the good times are going to come back again. I don't believe in that at all. I believe that the worst is yet to come. I believe that 2011 is going to show us a few more shocks on the global stage. I think that the reasons that gave rise to the conflict in the world in 2008 have still not been properly addressed. The world witnessed 8 or 10 years of greed, a lot of greed, and primarily driven in the finance industry, by investment banks, by corporates around the world, and it was just multiplying by itself. It had acquired a life of its own. So when the system came crashing down, when Lehman Brothers collapsed in 2008, we should have learned some lessons. We should have changed laws, regulations. We should have been significantly more focused on governance and amending the governance systems in the world to make sure that it didn't happen again. I don't think enough has been done on that front. And we are faced with a scenario where in Europe we have a fairly weak euro. I see the euro as being a German currency. And Germany is the sort of backdrop, if you like, of Europe. And we've already witnessed a crisis in Ireland, a crisis in Greece. I think this year we're going to see further crises in Portugal, possibly even in Spain and Italy. And the reason for that is that the whole system of operating according to very set targets and, you know, 3% budget deficits and so on, this was utopia land. I don't think these countries have learned the value of fiscal discipline. So a lot more is going to come out. At the same time, I think that the United States is going to head towards inflation because the US has been printing money and kicking the problem down the road. I think this administration is basically, by printing money, having these liquidity programs and so on, all it's doing is delaying the inevitable. Because as we all know, anybody who studied economics, once you increase your money supply that dramatically, if you don't have corresponding increases in productivity and in infrastructure growth, then somewhere along the line it will fuel inflation. At the same time, the US has got a very high rate of unemployment, which amongst working age males today is 20%. That's the highest it's been since the Depression in the 1920s and 30s. And that ratio, if you like, will lead to structural imbalance. It will lead to issues that we don't even know what those are out there. So that's the voice of doom and gloom, sorry. But I felt it's very important to set life in perspective. The other side, of course, is that we are living in a watershed moment. Some may agree, some may disagree, but I see power, economic power, political power, and the center of gravity shifting from the West towards the East. We shouldn't be surprised by this because, you know, America, England, Europe have not always been the global superpowers that they are today. This ascent, if you like, of the Anglo-Saxon era started with a very little known treaty in the late 17th century called the Treaty of Westphalia, which is where the Anglo-Saxon ascent started. And I think, historically speaking, every great empire rises and falls. It's had its time. So we've had the Roman Empire, we've had the Greek Empire, we've had the British Empire, we've even had the Muslim Empire. Came and went, okay? And so today we're living through a period which can be classified, whether it's the Anglo-Saxon Empire, the American Empire, but I certainly see that the power shifts that are happening today. I can give you a parallel in history as well, which is in 1870, Europe was going through a period where eventually went through a period of decline. It all came about in 1870 from the start of something called the municipal bond crisis, where large cities, the cities that we've come to admire today, Berlin, Paris, Vienna, etc., they'd just gone through a massive infrastructure burst of spending, and you know the roads and the buildings that we admire today were put down in that period. And when that crisis happened, rather than recovering to its full previous glory, what happened was Europe found itself competing against a new competitor that could build a cheaper, faster, quicker, that had an inexhaustible supply of labor, that had cheap and efficient sources and means of producing agriculture. And that competitor back then, the new kid on the block, was the United States of America. And today I find that the world where we are today, there is a new kid on the block. It's called China, and China hasn't even begun to flex its muscles yet. And I think that right now we're seeing a symbiotic relationship that exists between China and America. They're both tied at the hip. They both need each other. But there will come a point when the Chinese middle class will be sufficiently capable of buying locally. There'll be significantly more Chinese capacity to invest in other than U.S. government treasury bills. And I think that you're going to see a growing, dramatically growing, economically driven sphere of influence that China will exert. So that's just some views on the world as I see it today. And then we come down to the Middle East region. We are about oil. We've tried for many, many, many years to diversify away from that. I think that at the end of the day, when push comes to shove, it's also a security blanket, especially in the GCC. And it doesn't matter if oil is at $50 or $70 or $100. The point is, at any of those price levels, it's producing a surplus for the GCC region. And at the same time, it's an exhaustible resource. And so it's one day going to run out. But the reality is it's not going to run out anytime soon, whether it's 50 years or 100 years. The point is, we sit in this region, in the GCC, on 65% of the world's oil reserves. And yet, on an annual basis, we only produce about 27% of global oil production. So as the overall resource starts tapering off, the share of the GCC is going to keep getting higher and higher at higher price points. So I think from a monetary perspective, our future in this region is definitely assured. Now the question is, what are we going to do with that money and how are we going to spend it? And I'm delighted, and you all are delighted, I'm sure, as well, by the fact that increasingly the focus is on infrastructure. Increasingly, the focus is on education and healthcare and putting down systems in the ground that future generations are going to benefit from. And I think this is very wise. I think it's sensible. And I think that in terms of being command economies, very strong central governments, we also have a trickle-down effect into the private sector. And the private sector has not yet begun even to reap the benefit of it that we expect will happen and continue. So from a regional perspective, I see very positive news. I feel very strongly about this because, in my opinion, the region and its growth story has only just started. But at the same time, there is clouds on the horizon as well. Our politics, inevitably, on a regional basis, and by region I mean from Morocco on the one side to Pakistan on the other, on a regional basis, our politics are pretty messed up. We saw something happen in Tunisia a few days ago, which is symptomatic of a growing unemployment issue amongst the youth, discontent, and a big gap, a big income gap between the haves and the have-nots. And I think this is the real pressing issue that is going to face governments and policymakers in the Arab world in the years to come, which is how do we ensure the creation of a state which has got sufficient safety nets for its population. In Saudi Arabia, in the UAE, etc., I don't think it's a major issue because the population bases are small. But when you move further afield to countries like Egypt and Jordan and so on, I think these issues will become much more paramount and much more important. We have 50 million young people that will be entering the workforce in the next 5 to 7 years. And we need to have them getting jobs just to keep the rate of unemployment constant. Just to keep the rate of unemployment in the region constant. So the creation of jobs on a scale unheard of in this century. And that's a very, very important point. It's a point to focus on because in turn, it'll come back to what I want to talk to you about in terms of entrepreneurship and opportunity. So the youth are a big asset and also a big liability. The issues around employment cannot be solved by government alone. They have to be dealt with by the private sector. And in turn, what that means is that we've got to reinforce our educational systems. We've got to do a heck of a lot more in terms of seeing where we can add value and which companies, corporations, etc., are the winners in the future. I made some notes for myself, so I'm going to try and follow them. In this world that I've just painted and outlined, one of the key themes, as you all know, is globalization. I think the world has grown as a result of globalization. Almost 2 billion people globally have come out of poverty as a result of globalization. And yet, at the same time, there is a growing tendency towards protectionism, which in itself is very dangerous. And what I mean by that is try as a Saudi company to go and buy a strategic asset in the West. You'll very quickly be told, we need the money, but we don't want the asset. It happened with the UAE, and when Dubai Ports acquired P&O, they got it all over the world, but when it came to the US and buying ports in the US, it didn't seem to have the ability to consummate that transaction. That's happened 2 or 3 times since. It's not just happened with Arab companies, it's happened with Chinese companies as well. So the West is right now facing this dilemma where globalization is the engine of growth, and yet at a certain point, when it runs out of money, protectionism steps in as being the mechanism by which the rest of the world can be kept at bay. And globalization, of course, has its benefits as well. I mean, you know, just the power of the internet, just to see where things are going. If you imagine Facebook as being a country in terms of the number of its members, it would be the third largest country in the world. And Facebook is basically a mechanism, a tool, which has yet, till now, not found its feet. It's not public, it's still in an emerging stage. And how you utilize that database of knowledge, that capacity, the things that propel Google to being where it is, you know, a very interesting dynamic that will play itself out in the coming few years. There is going to be a new order, as I mentioned, and there's going to be a few more black swan moments. And what we need to see is how we all deal with it. The world is fundamentally going through change. That change, just to give you an example, is at every level, at business. I mean, let's just talk about climate for a second. 50% of the natural disasters that have occurred in the last 50 years in the world have only occurred in the last 10 years. That's a staggering statistic. So we're going through climate change, we're going through economic change. Only 8 out of the top 25 companies in the world in 1999 were in the same list in 2009. In just 10 years, only 8 out of those 25 survived. In 1999, most of those companies were in the technology space. In 2009, most of those companies are in the energy space or the finance space. In 1999, not a single Chinese company was in that list. In 2009, 4 companies are in that list. The world is changing. The world is changing at a pace that some of us may not be able to keep up to in terms of speed with. However, that is in itself the opportunity. You're all here attending an executive education course. You're here to enrich yourselves and grow more in knowledge. I can't possibly preach to you. Most of you are already accomplished in your business career or growing. So all I can do is give you ideas and thought processes that say that, again, in my opinion, this is an opportunity that needs to be seized. This is an opportunity that has got tremendous implications, because we are truly privileged to be living through a watershed moment in the world's history. And I'm not talking about the normal order. I'm saying that if you follow the logic of some of the things that I've said, whether it's climate change, whether it's economic power shifting from west to east, whether it's the demographic challenge, whether it's the business governance issues that definitely need to be addressed as the world evolves away from the Lehman disaster. I think any of these, if one of these takes center stage, the world will be a very different place. So what I'm trying to tell you is the only constant that we need to cope with is change. And really what you need to equip yourself with is the ability to deal with change and the ability to benefit and profit of change. One thing I'm very fond of saying is that today's peacock is tomorrow's feather duster. If you don't evolve and if you don't change, that's what you're going to be. So we all have to continuously keep thinking about ways and means that we can understand from, profit from, and learn from what we're experiencing in the world around us. And sometimes it's too easy to say, well, that doesn't affect me, I'm not bothered. In today's globalized world, everything affects everybody. And I think that's the important thing. I think one of the key messages that we need to focus on is move away from short-term thinking and move into long-term value creation. There are core values that you need to embrace. The first of which I live by, is that you have a stakeholder community, not a shareholder community in your corporate environment. And if you practice that, and if you think of what I'm saying, it's no longer about making profits for your shareholders, earning a good salary and a bonus, and saying that's sufficient. In tomorrow's world, every company is going to need a license to operate. And I don't mean like a physical piece of paper. It's going to need a license to operate from its stakeholders and its community. And what I mean by that is that you've got to start working within the context, not just of employer, employee, or shareholder, but the community you're working with, the corner shop, which depends on its livelihood, for its livelihood, on your custom, on your suppliers, on your customers. The whole environment needs to be thought of very holistically. We need to focus a little bit more on governance. And most important of all, we need to remain relevant. Use of the word relevant is very important. I heard it from the Singaporean ex-prime minister. And he actually had a whole two-hour discussion around the use of the word relevant. He said, not important, not a VIP, not critical, not profitable, but relevant. Because if you are relevant to your ecosystem, if you're relevant in a holistic way to your stakeholder community, then that relevance itself will propel you into prosperity. And the last thing around that topic that I wanted to talk about is, in any sustainable ecosystem, we have to recognize that the basis of any corporation, the basis of any thinking, is human capital. It's not machines. It's the brains that gave rise to the machines. And human capital, gentlemen, is transportable. Human capital needs to be valued and nurtured, whether it comes from the country in which it's working or from elsewhere. And that human talent needs to be grown, evolved, developed, because it has a choice. It can walk away. And therefore, whether on a corporate structure, on a national structure, or even on a religious structure, the more we respect the people that we're working with, the more we give them the tools by which we grow, the easier we'll be dealing with the imperatives of the new order that I'm talking about. Businesses, certainly in our part of the world, large businesses, need to engage much more with governments. I was in Sharm el-Sheikh yesterday, attending the Arab League summit, in which, for the very first time, business was an item on the agenda. Business was brought in by governments as being the mechanism by which policymakers and planners can execute those plans. And if business is not a partner, all governments today know that they cannot just succeed on their own or through their vision. There was a lot of talk yesterday around entrepreneurship, and around infrastructure and around job creation. So my view is that it doesn't matter whether you're running a big company or a small company, whether you're a middle manager or a senior manager, if you embrace the thinking around entrepreneurship, if you understand that every single entrepreneur is in effect an agent of change. I'd like to talk to you now about my view on entrepreneurship. Is this phenomenon called entrepreneurship, is the cause that gives rise to it an individual, or is it impersonal forces that give rise to entrepreneurship? And what I mean by that is, do great moments in history happen because Alexander the Great or Sam Walton or Einstein gave rise to a new form of thinking? Every time somebody speaks, they always say, switch off the phone. Sorry. There we go. Every time that happens, I was talking about entrepreneurship, sorry, I lost my track there. So what is it that gives rise to it in the first place? Is it history that created, impersonal force that created the feudal revolution, the industrial revolution, the rise of the internet and so on? Or was it the individual that gave rise to that moment? It doesn't actually matter, because my view is that Alexander the Great or Newton or Einstein have a lot in common with entrepreneurs typically that we think of, for example, Rockefeller or Ford, or closer to home, Saleh Kamel or Suleiman Oleyan. The thing that they have in common is that they are all agents of change, all entrepreneurs, both sides. You don't have to be a businessman to be an entrepreneur. An entrepreneur is anyone that is an agent of change. They break from ranks, they define risk, and they change the status quo. And my definition of an entrepreneur is five or six points that I've found in common with most entrepreneurs that I've met in my life. I tried to switch it off, and you know what happened? I couldn't get the password in. So now I'm going to do it slowly, and I'm going to go like that, and it's off. There we go. They all have an incredible degree of willpower. This is a defining attribute of good entrepreneurs. Sometimes that can even go towards bloody-mindedness, but they all have extremely strong inherent willpower. They all have insatiable curiosity. They all want to know, what is this, and why, and what does it do? They all have clarity of vision. They have determination. They have discipline. They have focus. These are all key words, but they're important words as well. And they're very, very adaptable. If you go back to my example of today's peacock is tomorrow's feather duster, if you don't adapt, you are consigned to history. They're dreamers and they're workaholics at the same time, and there's nothing wrong, and there's absolutely no dichotomy between those two words. You can merge them as well. But the most important of all is all of them who are successful have an unrelenting, unquestionable, unassailable, unyielding commitment to integrity. Because, gentlemen, at the basis of anything that you do, if you do it with integrity, if you do it with clarity, you will succeed. And I think all great entrepreneurs have that in common with each other. It's very fashionable to say that entrepreneurship is also a celebration of failure. I don't believe that at all. When people say that, a lot of entrepreneurs have failed time and time again, I say that's the ones that didn't make it. If you look at the ones that did make it, whether it's Bill Gates or it's Richard Branson or whoever you seek to define that along. And again, coming back closer to home, I'll use again Suleiman Oleyan as an example, because I was privileged to work for him and with him, and he was a mentor, so I know the way he lived his life. But all of these people are actually incredibly detail-oriented. They're all incredibly focused on business planning. They're very, very driven by the detail and by their, fear, if you like, of failure. So entrepreneurship is not just about taking the risk and being willing to bet the house on it. It's also take the risk, bet the house, but make sure that you've done enough, sufficient, careful planning, and you've got enough safeguards built in and enough what ifs thought through that success becomes more or less assured. So that's an important attribute about entrepreneurship as well. And what does it take for an entrepreneur to excel? It's an important point. I think it needs a lot of clarity. It needs a single-mindedness. It needs planning, as I mentioned. Entrepreneurship is an art form. It's not a science. You really can't learn it. You should have the basics in place, and then you should learn. You should be curious. You should look around, and you should think where you can be adaptable. It requires a very strong awareness of your environment. And as I said, it needs stakeholder support. I'll give you a very small example. This event that Dr. Mustafa was referring to, Celebration of Entrepreneurship. I'll tell you why we did it. I've been a very firm believer for a very long time that the SME space is the real engine of growth in this region. Across the region, 80% of people are employed by SMEs. They're not employed by the Aramcos and the Dubai Worlds and the big corporations that are out there. That's the noise. 80% of the people in this region that are employed by SMEs. Yet, only 26 to 28% of our GDP collectively from this region comes from SMEs. That gap is humongous. Imagine if that gap went up towards 50 and that came down towards 50. This region would be in a period of sustainable economic boom and economic growth that more or less no force could stop or turn around. Think through the fact that in the early 90s, 40 million new American jobs were created by companies that were less than 4 years old and that were below a certain threshold in size. That tells you how an economy that today constitutes 23% of global GDP relies on for its own growth as well. And that is what I'm trying to point out to you as a key determinant of this region's future is SMEs. And what are SMEs? SMEs are basically businesses that are started by entrepreneurs. It's businesses that are started by people like you and me who go there with a vision, a plan, an idea, arguably some funding, maybe no funding. And over time, they attract funding. But that's the mechanism by which these businesses then go out and employ others. Does our banking system in the region understand SMEs? No. Do our governments in the region understand SMEs? No. Do business people really properly understand the opportunity in SMEs? No. And again, if you think about what I'm trying to say, this segment, this sector, which I define as a potential engine of growth, has got so much built in terms of momentum, that I believe that the spirit of trade, which is entrepreneurship, which excels as a result of having high quality SMEs on the ground, is really the engine of our future growth. So at Abraj, what we did is we've always been known, again by the grace of God, alhamdulillah, we started from zero beginnings in 2002, and today we're the largest firm in the world in emerging markets. We're the largest firm in the world outside North America and Europe. We're the only firm from our part of the world in the world top 50 in private equity. And we got there through entrepreneurship, through bloody mindedness, through hard work, through drive, and through trust from investors. Having done that space, having occupied the PE space for so long, we felt that it was important to focus on the SME segment. And that is why working with a variety of actually multilateral institutions, the IFC, the World Bank, the IDB, US multilateral agency, OPIC, the European Investment Bank, putting all of them together as potential and then current investors with the private sector investors that we really had, we put together a fund of around $750 million that was only ever going to focus on this space. But as you know, that's a lot of money. And you cannot deploy that kind of money in one single country. And then the flip side of it is, every country has got its own SME program. Egypt has its own SME program. Jordan has its own SME program. The UAE has its own. Saudi Arabia has its own. So they're all focused on their domestic consumers and their domestic market. But the real reality of scaling is the Arab world. If you think about it, there are 350 million people Arab world, that is bigger than the United States of America, that is bigger than the European market, they all have one thing in common, which is language, culture, and religion. That market size is massive. No one thinks regionally except the Arab League. And what does the Arab League do? Disagree. All right? So the bottom line is, market that is waiting to be tapped. We're not the only people that want to do it. I'm sure a lot of other industries want to do it too. So we started off by addressing the segment, the sector. We said we understand it. We hired lots of people that were that got their basic training in this area. And then we raised the money from the agencies that I was telling you about. And then we said, how do we pull together entrepreneurs? We could have had an event that said, the entrepreneurship conference. No. We said, let's celebrate entrepreneurship. Because entrepreneurship is not recognized often enough, is not dealt with on a regional basis, and we need to go out there and celebrate it. So we created this event in Dubai that Dr. Mustafa was talking about, and we thought we'd have 700 or 800 people. We had nearly 3,000 people come. And fortunately, we had a lot of space where we could accommodate them. We had 250 speakers over 2 days. We had absolutely zero formality. We had the biggest business people in the region sitting and talking to the youngest business people in the region. And we learned about stories that we never knew were out there. There was this one company which really, really inspired me. Two young entrepreneurs in Dubai created a company called Wild Pita. It's pita bread, it's the shawarma stand. But what they did is they started with one shop and they said, we'll make a shawarma out of anything that the guy who's come in wants to eat. And they built their community of customers through Facebook. Now you think about this. They built it through Facebook. It was urban chic at its best. And today they have 7 restaurants. Today they've grown to a point where they're looking to expand regionally. They have countless offers of money. And they have 180,000 followers on Facebook. Now that to me is innovation. And that to me is thinking out of the box. So there are many examples that I can give you that, you know, will inspire you around entrepreneurship. Examples from this region. And you don't have to be big and famous for someone to get inspired by you. The story I just told you is two young 23, 24-year-old kids who left their work, their jobs. They both used to work at Unilever and followed a dream, which is I can be someone in my own right and I can do things that that can make a difference. I want to go back a little bit to talking about this license to operate that I was talking about. And I want to talk about what that means in terms of the stakeholder community. Because there's a word around this that I'm very fond of using. It's called inclusive growth, not exclusive growth. Include your environment and use it to grow. Give you an example around how that can happen. At Abraj, we own 35 companies. Each of them employs tens of thousands of people, so on a consolidated basis, we employ over 200,000 people. And each of these companies is profitable in its own right and is a market leader. Now, we at Abraj, from our very beginning, have had a policy of giving 5% of our top line revenue, not bottom line, top line revenue to sustainable causes and into what we call strategic philanthropy. And that meant that we were giving away tens of millions of dollars a year throughout the region in what we felt was sustainable philanthropic causes. And then we hit upon the idea, hang on a second, let's stop trying to be, you know, the only saint in town. Let's try and make this more inclusive. So we went to the companies that we own and we said to them, we don't want you to give 5% of your top line, because if you do that, we'll lose money. Do is develop a program which is very similar to our program, which we call 5 plus 5 plus 5. And what that means is that we give 5% of our top line on a voluntary basis, are encouraged to give 5% of their bonuses. Remember, I was talking about human talent, and in the financial services industry, those numbers add up to a lot. And then we said, we also want you to give up 5 days of your time, of which we'll pay for half and you pay for half, we told our employees. But go and spend those 5 days applying your skill set that you have into social NGOs and into organizations that we're supporting. That program today, alhamdulillah, 5-6 years on, is extremely successful. But when we took that to our portfolio companies, we met a bit of resistance because they said, hang on, you're the guys that have imposed these business plans on us. We have to work, you know, twice as hard to get to these profit targets. How are we going to do it? And we showed them again the mechanism of inclusive growth and how they can go about doing it. And this year, inshallah, 2011, we're getting to a point where we expect each of our companies will be able, through cost reduction, through mobilizing their own communities, and through just, you know, I hope you can hear me. So each of our companies will be able to put up into a $1 billion. That means that this year we'll have another $80 million to spend in sustainable philanthropy. And that's an example which I wanted to tell you about, which is every company, every individual can make a massive difference in the ecosystem in which they operate, because that is just so much money. And if it's going into the right causes and it's going into the right products, then that in itself is something that we should all be very proud of. Finally, if I can, I think I talked about the SMEs that I wanted to. I wanted to just touch a little bit on the role of the individual. You may have noticed I'm trying very hard to stay away from both talking about Abraj and talking about myself, because I feel that, you know, actions should speak louder than words, and the worst thing in the world is when people stand up and preen or read about themselves on a screen. I think it's so much more important to lead by example and let the rest of the world talk about it. So if you want to know more about Abraj, there are lots of case studies on us in business schools. I hope Mile will also do one on Abraj soon. I hope you will. You'll join Harvard and Yale and Stanford as being people that have done case studies on us. So I'll be very proud the day you do it. But I want just to conclude by talking about and reaching out to you and saying that if anything, the individual can make a difference. You as individuals are all important people. It doesn't matter what positions you occupy in your company, you're important to your own ecosystem, you're important to yourself and your families, and you're important in terms of the change agent that you can become. That's very, very important. If you get enthused by the concept that it's not just about going to work every day, but it's also about doing a little bit more. I'm sure everybody here does stuff fairly silently. I've always grown up with the view that Islam says your left hand should not know what your right hand does in terms of charity and sustainable causes. I practiced all my life to that principle. And then I came across somebody who issued me a fatwa. He said, no, my friend, when you are in a position where others listen to you and even look up to you, it is your responsibility in a community to talk about what you do so that others can do it too. I don't intend for you to think that we as Abraj or me personally does a lot of this, but I would love to have you stimulate your brain cells around the thinking process that I've articulated. It doesn't have to be money. It doesn't have to be, I hate the use of the word charity because it implies inequality, but it doesn't have to be money. It doesn't even have to be time. It has to come out of your mind saying, today I will do this that will make a difference in my ecosystem. And I think if you do that, then not only will you be a better person, I think that your environment will be richer and better off thanks to your efforts. So I'm going to end with a quote that I picked up from Mark Twain, which I'm going to read to you because it made a difference to me. I liked what it said. It said, 20 years from now, you will be more disappointed by the things that you didn't do, not by the things that you did do. So explore, dream, discover, don't hold yourself back. And that's really the message that I wanted to convey to all of you. I thank you for listening to me. I thank you for having invited me. And if there's any questions or anything else, I'm happy to answer them now or ever.
5 minutes for questions and answers.
Is the concept of entrepreneurship a characteristic of an individual, or it can also apply to organizations, small or medium?
I think without question, it can apply to both. Entrepreneurship is, if you remember what I was saying earlier, it's the agent of change. It's the process by which something that used to happen in a certain way now happens in a different way. I gave the example of Sam Walton and Rockefeller, but I also gave the example of Newton and Einstein. Apples fall on people's heads all the time. It just happened to have fallen on the right head that he turned around and said, here's the law of gravity. Okay? So that goes to the individual. In terms of organizations, I mean, you take an organization like GE, it's phenomenally entrepreneurial, and it continuously is reinventing itself. So wherever change is involved, wherever thought processes lead you outside the status quo, that's, in my opinion, entrepreneurship. So individuals can have it, companies can have it.
So my question is, from your experience, what do you think are the top three sectors in this region where you advise entrepreneurs to enter to? And do you think that this sector could turn that entrepreneur into, you know, his company into more SME and potentially an IPO, you know, in 10 to 15 years' time?
Sure. Look, infrastructure is the big theme in this region. And what I mean by infrastructure, the traditional definition of infrastructure, which my Western friends will embrace and understand, is roads, bridges, highways, power plants. I look at infrastructure differently. I say infrastructure is anything that helps a country or a region go to its next stage of development. So you have to include, by definition, schools, hospitals, logistics, essential services in that. We're deficient in that. We have 33,000 schools as a gap just in the GCC in terms of needing that. McKinsey did a report where they said that all our hospitals in the GCC are turned in the wrong direction. We built them in the 50s and 60s and 70s, okay, where they were general purpose hospitals. The diseases of the GCC are diabetes, obesity, heart conditions. We don't have centers of excellence there. There's opportunity. There's opportunity in schooling. There's opportunity in logistics. There's opportunity in anything that you want to set your mind to do. That's the key message. There isn't a formula that says, if I invest in this, I'm going to land up going IPO. You follow your instinct, you follow your heart, and then you apply your brain. And if you share and push and make it happen, it doesn't matter what sector you put your mind on, it'll work. Examples of the sectors I gave, take oil and gas. On the one extreme, you have BP and the big global companies, Aramco, right, which are involved in oil and gas. But you also have the really, really small service providers that feed into the oil and gas industry. So whatever it is that takes your fancy, so long as it's coming from your heart, your head, you're determined, you have the vision, you have the capacity for hard work, you plan hard enough, there's no reason why you won't be successful.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for your very thought-invoking speech. I mean, it put a lot of thoughts in my head, and I'm sure in my colleagues' head as well. My question is that depending on the region of the world you're in, government's intervention and its role in spurring entrepreneurship and SMEs varies.
Sorry?
The role of government in spurring entrepreneurship and developing the SME sector varies.
Yes.
In a lot of government settings where the government is hands-off, like the United States, they just develop a regulation that sort of ignites it, and then they leave it up to the private sector. Mm-hmm. At SAGIA, we have this motto that the business of government is to get out of business. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, in Saudi Arabia, government is very well ingrained in all major initiatives. So where do you see the sort of the barrier or the gray zone of what the balance should be between how much government does and leads, so initiatives like, for instance, the TCF in Saudi and others, versus what is necessary for the SMEs and the entrepreneurs to get it done on their own?
Sajaya is obviously a business that's working because you even sound like my friend Amar Dabagh. Look, governments should be in the business of governance, not in the business of management. That's just point number one. So it's not rocket science to think that through. That's very, very important. They should only be in the business of governance. Governance is a very big topic. It's a very big area. So what governments should be doing is creating enabling environments. I'm very outspoken about this. And one day I will get into trouble around it too, because that's just the way life goes. But the reality is, the enabling environment is the role of government. What the private sector has to do is to learn from the rules that it faces, lobby to change them where it doesn't work, and then move on with life. Outside of Saudi Arabia, very few people know that Saudi Arabia has got one of the most advanced companies law regulations and capital market regulations anywhere in the world. Because you learned from many, many different systems and experiences. But Saudi Arabia does not project that well enough. That's another very important point. It is world class. It is, you know, in terms of competitiveness, you went from number 90 to number 11 in a 5-year span. That's a massive accomplishment. But that came from leadership and drive. Now, there's one part of the question that you addressed when you talked to the United States. You said governments create the enabling environment and then get out of the way. The single biggest factor that spurs entrepreneurship is the presence of a bankruptcy law. We don't have a bankruptcy law in any country in the region. And that's bad. Most of the company's law that we have in every country in the region stems either from British or French judicial systems that go back 50 or 60 years in terms of their drafting. And these are the things that governments need to focus on, change them, and then leave the business of business to the private sector. Because if you think out there in this audience, people here, and one of you comes up with that great idea, in a marketplace of 350 million people, let me promise you, you will be Bill Gates. You will be bigger than Bill Gates. There is absolutely nothing when you have an enabling environment that you have the guy who created Facebook not coming out of Saudi Arabia or Oman or the UAE. It's just a product. It could have been created anywhere. In today's globalized world, we must not be second best. We must strive to be the best. But that only comes not from intellectual arrogance. It comes from hard work and it comes from education. The total number of patents that have been registered in the Arab world over the last 5 years is less than the number of patents that have been registered in 1 month in the New York Patent Office. 5 years, all the countries in the Arab world, 1 month, US Patent Office. That speaks to innovation. That speaks to education. We have 380 universities in the Arab world, throughout the Arab world. Japan alone has more universities. If we focus on education and bringing the youth into a focused, targeted program, stuff that you, which is defining leadership, education is the nexus and the nub of what is going to enable us to break out of the trap that we find ourselves in.
Yes, following your what you stated, that it's good sometimes to share the charity and good things with others, just to encourage others and to seek advices. I'm a managing director of a company, family. Yeah, I'm managing director for a company that we have approved a sufficient budget for CSR, and even more that we have an approved just to use our resources partially to the CSR initiative. But CSR is not part of our competencies, and I believe this is a very common issue. The willingness that we do have, what comes next for us or for a company like us to utilize this positive initiative to the best? What comes next? What is the next step?
You are the next step.
I'm under your hand.
Yeah, but you are the next step. You said you're the managing director of the business. You have an approved budget. It has to come from how you believe where it should be spent. There is no science to CSR. Identify in your community or outside your community a cause, a project, an idea that is worth supporting. Support it with money, but more importantly, support it with your people's time. CSR is not just about the cash and the budget. It's about the inclusiveness of having 10 people get up and say, I'm willing to go and do this on a Friday. I'll give up one of my days because you know what? It makes me feel better as a human being. That process can only be driven by you as the leader. Yeah, but you choose the cause and you choose the process. The rest is up to you. I'm going to sit next to you at dinner.
You stated a fact at the beginning of your presentation. You said that entrepreneurship is highly overlooked, especially in this part of the world. Like, do governments know about it? Do banks know about it? So that leads us to a fact of an obstacle to be a successful entrepreneur in this part of the world, which is access to venture capital. So from your experience working as an entrepreneur in this part of the world, how easy it is to access venture capital, and what could be a trick of the trade, for example, to approach banks, investors, I don't know. So that's the question.
I think it's a great question, and I'm going to take a bit of time in answering it, if you don't mind. I think it's a great question, because this is the gap that existed in this region. There was no venture capital capacity. The big reason why there was no venture capital capacity is because the private equity capacity was still working its way through the system. Secondly, countries had small markets. Our success from the time that we took Aramex private out of NASDAQ in 2002 and refloated it in Dubai 5 years later, 4 years later, at 10 or 15 times the value that we bought, was we took a business that was a Jordanian business and we made it a regional business. We've done the same thing countless times with ArabTech, with XYZ. I can keep going on, right? We're not the only people that have done it. Many people have done it. So the first recognition is that there is a regional market. It's a big market. Cevola is a company that has grown on the back of being a regional market player. You can get its products just as easily in Morocco as you can in Egypt, as you can in Saudi Arabia. What did they do? They exploited the power of the internet, satellite TV, and common marketing platforms to be able to reach their consumer, which is essentially the Arab consumer, right? So that's just one example. You have numerous other examples as well that are very successful. For venture capital to succeed, you need a big marketplace. Because unlike private equity, where you have to be a sniper, you have to take aim at one target and shoot. In venture capital, you've got to have a machine gun. You've got to fire lots of times in order to hope that one or two will strike the target. So this is the time when venture capital is beginning to come into its own. Why do you find people like me, or Nagib Saviris, or Amar Dabbagh, or Fadi Khandur, and the list can go on, now talking about it? Because it is important from our perspective, having succeeded as business people, it is incumbent on us, it is our responsibility to talk to governments to convince them that they need to start taking a regional platform thinking and they need to start doing more on the venture capital space, because that's where the youth will derive their entrepreneurship capacity from.
Thank you very much. I think we conclude, if you allow me. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Arif. This is the
Thank you.